coming up on Philosophy Talk.
People do a lot of very hard thinking, or at least report doing a lot of very hard thinking in images.
Where are the images we see in our imagination?
Are they projected like slides on the insides of our brain?
Do you really mean that there's an image in the mind? Who's looking at that image if it's there? That doesn't make any sense.
Do we think in images or in words?
The deep question at stake here is, what is the currency of thought? John Maynard Keynes was once asked, do you think in pictures or do you think in words? And he said, I think in thoughts.
Picture this, a day in December. Picture this, my telephone number. What I wanted, but I'm telling you, oh yeah.
Are mental images essential to thought?
Our guest is Stanford psychologist Lera Boroditsky.
This question goes to the very core of cognitive science, a very core concern. What are thoughts actually made of?
Mental imagery, coming up on Philosophy Talk
after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that often begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, but sometimes in Antonio's Nut House down on California Avenue in Palo Alto.
And wherever they begin, they migrate to this lovely oasis of the radio, and from there to the internet via our blog first, the blog.philosophytalk.org, and now also via podcast, which you can download by checking out our website. John, our topic today is mental imagery, but it's kind of weird that we're doing this because I thought that that was just consigned to the dustbin of philosophical history. In graduate school, I learned there are words in our heads, no pictures in our heads.
Well, Ken, since I'm older and wiser, I'll give you a little historical perspective about the importance of mental imagery. Back in the 17th century...
Yeah, I know you remember that.
Yes, right. I remember it well. My friend Rene said, look, we're not in direct contact with objects and properties in the world. How do we know about them? Answer, they cause images in our mind. We'll call them ideas, but pretty much thought of them as visual images. Solves two big problems. How does our mind think about things in the world? How do we have this of relation? Well, pictures resemble what they're of. Mental images resemble what they're of. And how do we have knowledge? They cause the mental images in us. So, theory of representative ideas, mental image is a big part of it. Terrific theory, right?
Yeah, well, you know, but the reason it was consigned to the dustbin of philosophical history is because although it's a cool first thought that gripped lots of philosophers, it's not a cool second thought. Because, okay, so mental images or pictures are supposed to represent by resemblance. But wait a minute. What does a picture most resemble? Another picture. Right. And you don't think pictures are pictures of pictures, do you?
That's a good point. If you take the picture of Aristotle and Raphael's famous picture of the School of the Academy or whatever it was, does that resemble Aristotle? Well, who knows? I mean, Aristotle, insofar as he exists, is a pile of dust, and who knows what he looked like. So it doesn't solve that problem.
But Think about your knowledge one. Okay, I have this image before my head, and by this picture before my head, and by that, I know the world? Well, no, I know the picture. That's what's before my mind. And how do I know there's anything outside the picture? So it doesn't really, it just leads to skepticism, because we don't know whether there are any resemblances to reality.
Yeah, but, you know, it's kind of unfair that mental images got put in the dustbin, because do mental words do any better?
Well, but words don't have to resemble what they represent in order to represent them. That's the thing. So words have a power to represent without resembling.
So there's conventions that give our ideas meanings. It's an even stupider idea than the resemblance
idea. We'll
talk
about that. But look here, philosophers did consign mental imagery to the dustbin of history. Lots of arguments about that. But cognitive science has resurrected this idea. And one of our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Corneli, went out and talked to one of the leading theorists of mental imagery. She files this report.
I wanted to find out how mental imagery really works, so I turned to someone who studies these things. Stephen Coslin is a Harvard psychology professor who's been researching mental imagery since the 70s.
Would you mind if I ask you a question or two?
He invited me to participate in a little experiment.
This may seem rather odd at the outset. Do you know what shape Mickey Mouse's ears are?
They're round.
Excellent. All right, bear with me for a moment, if you will. What shape are they?
They're round.
That's right. One more time. What shape are they?
They're round.
Okay, good. Now, I bet the first time you answered that question, you visualized the rodent's head and saw the ears.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, but by the third time, you didn't.
Right, I was just repeating what I already knew.
Right, what shape are they again?
They're round.
So, the distinction here is that you've got a lot of information stored that you don't know you know. But if I ask you a few times, you'll recode that information into a verbal form and store that so you don't need to use the image anymore.
Kosslyn says two competing processes are going on in my brain, a subconscious one that lets me recall things quickly and a visual one which takes more time.
So in fact, there's kind of a mental race going on all the time, like a horse race, where when you're asked a question, the brain is both searching for lists and facts that have been coded in a verbal, kind of linguistic way. At the same time, it's going to try to create an image. Whichever process wins is going to produce the response, and the other one will just stop.
Besides helping us remember things about the past, mental imagery allows us to make projections about the future.
Let's say you have to load your trunk. You've got a bunch of baggage. It's a lot easier on the muscles if you look at the trunk, look at the baggage, and mentally project images of the various bags and move them around and sort of see the best configuration before you actually start to lug them up and put them in.
What's more, Kosslyn says imagery doesn't have to refer to visual images. He claims there's all kinds of imagery, including auditory imagery.
You know the old kid's song, Three Blind Mice?
Yes.
First three notes. They go up and they go down.
They go down. Oh, but I had to picture that in my mind's ear in order to...
Unless you've thought about it before, it's exactly like the Mickey Mouse case.
So I can have images in my head of all kinds of perceptions, but aren't there some things we just can't visualize? For example, what does truth look like? Or any abstract concept for that matter?
In fact, that was one of the original critiques. The trouble is, how do you represent a triangle? Triangles in general, rather, with any particular triangle. I mean, any particular image of a triangle is going to be an image of that triangle, right? Your right triangle or an isosceles triangle or some other particular triangle. So how do you do triangles in general? It's not so easy to answer that. So the bottom line seems to be that you can use images as vehicles for thought, but you need something else as well, some way to interpret what they mean.
Psychologists still disagree about what form those underlying thoughts actually take. Some, like Rutgers professor Zenon Polition, believe we can't actually think in pictures, but only in a kind of mental language. Polition has criticized Stephen Kosslyn's experiments, saying essentially the subjects only thought they were thinking in pictures. But Kosslyn says he's starting to look at brain images to prove mental imagery is real.
There are areas of the brain that are literally laid out physically, like the back of the eye, so you can see patterns on the surface of the brain someone's looking at. And you can see that during vision, and we've also done it now in imagery.
Right now, I have a mental image. The end of this report. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
Thanks, Zoe. I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
I thought that was an excellent report, Zoe, if you're listening. That was really superb. We're joined today by Lara Boroditsky. She's a famous professor of cognitive psychology at Stanford University. Lara, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you, Ken.
Lara, if we just introspect a little, it seems obvious that there are images in our mind. My mind is full of images, just all the time. So what's the big deal? Why has the topic of mental imagery created controversy in philosophy and science?
Yeah, you don't need brain scans and all that stuff Kosslyn was talking about. Just introspect.
Well, it's true. A lot of people are just like you, John. They believe that they see images in their mind. Other people, on the other hand, say, you know what? I don't see any images in my mind. I think in words. And some people even say something else. So John Maynard Keynes was once asked, do you think in pictures or do you think in words? And he said, I think in thoughts.
So, clever man, Keynes.
So introspection doesn't necessarily tell you the answer, because in a psychology lab, suppose one lab, you sit around and you think about how you think and you say, ah, I see images. But suppose another person in their lab sits around and says, ah, I don't see images. Then you have a problem.
Well, you know, it seems to me that what they're really arguing about is what we mean by a visual image. I mean, some philosophers talk as if visual images were little pictures that got between you and what you're looking at, whereas others think of it as sort of an activity that you understand. People who don't say they don't have visual images understand what we mean when we say, well, kind of visualize your car. So I'm not sure there are really any people that don't have visual images in that weaker sense.
So what's at stake between cognitive psychologists and cognitive scientists debating this? What do they think they're arguing over? What's a mental image supposed to be? I think John is asking you to...
Well... It's a great question. Over the course of this debate, the idea of a mental image has become refined, and people have started asking, what exactly is it? Do you have to have metric properties? Do you have to preserve distance? Do you have to preserve certain details? Because one observation is that people's mental images are not very detailed. So if I ask you to draw a penny, for example, now a penny is an object you've seen thousands of times. But people can't remember where things are on the penny, which way the face is pointing, what the words are. And so people have argued that because if you had a really good image of a penny, if that's how you knew about the world, you wouldn't have that kind of problem.
Well, now back a couple hundred years ago, when last time I really read up on mental imagery, there was this astounding result called the Perky effect, right? You tell someone to visualize a penny, and while they're visualizing a penny, you actually, unknown to them, have a penny-like shape appear actually that they actually perceive, and they don't notice it. Doesn't that show that there are visual images, or is that kind of dated?
You could argue about any of the results in mental imagery, and in fact, there has been a raging debate. So I imagine what Zenon Polition would say is, well, that image of a penny that you project activates a symbol in your mind that is something like penny, and so you're faster to perform the task.
I can form an image of Zenon Polition saying that.
But look, Lara and John, before we get into, you know, what the evidence is, which I think we really need to dig into, I still want to know what's at stake. People arguing back and forth about it. You would think this wouldn't cause so much controversy, but you read the psychology journals, and it's raging. And people call people nasty names over this stuff. I mean, this debate between Polition and Coslin seems to me nasty. What are they arguing about exactly? I mean, is it that there has to be, you look in there and you find a little picture, like oh yeah, there's a, I can spot a picture on the wall, there's a calendar, picture on that calendar. Is it like I look in the brain and see, is there one of those in there? Is that what we're debating about?
Well, the deep question at stake here is, what is the currency of thought? What are thoughts made of? So this question goes to the very core of cognitive science, the very core concern, what are thoughts actually made of? That's what people are arguing about. And people have gone back and forth. So some people have argued, kind of like you just laid out, you know, do you really mean that there's an image in the mind? Who's looking at that image if it's there? That doesn't make any sense. On the other hand, you say, you know, you could make the same argument for symbolic representations. Oh, there are symbolic representations in the mind. Well, who's understanding those symbolic representations in there? So we're trying to figure out what is the currency of thought.
Some people worry that the image, for there to be mental imagery, there has to be a viewer of the image in the head. So it's not just that I view with the image, but there's some little guy in me viewing the image.
Sure, but you have the same problem for words or symbolic representations. Someone has to be in there understanding it. Whatever currency you pick, you're going to have something that creates meaning.
Suppose I go to Google or Yahoo and get directions from going from my house, say, to my grandson's soccer game. I'll get two things. I'll get a map, and I'll get a list of directions. They both, in some sense, contain the information, but in very different ways. Now, surely that difference between the public text and images can somehow have some significance to the question of how they're stored in our mind.
After the break, I'm going to take up John's challenge there. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is mental imagery. Our guest is Lara Boroditsky from Stanford University.
We've been talking about the mental imagery debate and whether we think in pictures or in words. Next, we'll continue that, and we'll also look into the scientific evidence and philosophical arguments about mental imagery. You can join us by calling toll-free 1-800-525-9917. I'll repeat, 1-800-525-9917.
The cognitive science and philosophy of mental imagery, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
John Perry, let me repeat the question with which we ended the last segment. We're wondering about this debate that cognitive psychologists have about how we think. What's the medium of thought? Is it images or text or both? And I'm just saying that, well, when we're not thinking about what's going on inside our mind, but when we think of what goes on outside our mind, it seems like images, like a map, and text, like a set of directions, can organize the same information in very different ways. So that would seem to be a clue to this question of how we do things in the mind.
It's definitely the case that if you give people a map and ask them to navigate somewhere, or you give them route instructions, people will make different kinds of mistakes. They'll remember different things about the information that you give them. So clearly, the input channels are different.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk today, folks. Our topic is mental imagery. Do you think in words or in pictures? Are some subjects easier to describe in words? Or do you find a picture's always worth 1,000 words? Suppose I said, Halle Berry. What comes to mind? A sentence? A picture? Join us. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. My guest is Lara Boroditsky. Lara, so I'm going to ask you another kind of question. Okay. This is a hot topic in cognitive science. And I know you're on the image side of it. What makes you believe in the existence of mental imagery? What scientific evidence makes you believe?
There's a mounting amount of evidence showing that people use mental images, and that mental images actually preserve a lot of the same properties that that pictures out in the world have. So, for example, Steve Coslin has done experiments to show that mental images have size or that they can be transformed. So to give you an idea, if you imagine, if I ask you to imagine a rabbit next to a fly or a rabbit next to an elephant.
Okay, I'm trying to do
okay.
that.
Okay. Now, after you've imagined the rabbit next to a fly, suppose I ask you, does the rabbit have whiskers? Now, to answer that question, it takes you a lot less time if you've imagined a rabbit next to a fly than you've imagined it next to an elephant, because the rabbit is a lot smaller next to the elephant, and it's harder to see the whiskers in your image. So that's a scientific finding that Steve Coslin has. Another demonstration that people often use is that mental images, just like images in the world, can be transformed and you can make new images. So suppose I ask you to imagine a capital letter D. Now turn it on its side so that the flat part of the D is facing down. And now imagine a capital J and slide that capital J so that the flat part of the J aligns perfectly with the flat part of the D. What do you see?
Oh, I don't know. I see a J on top of a D. And it's like a, I don't know what it is.
A J is under the D.
Oh, under.
Yeah. So oh, we got it.
Oh, right.
Well, maybe some people in the audience got it. It's an umbrella.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I see.
And so the idea is that because you can transform images into new forms in your mind, that must mean that they have some kind of.
Not doing that. And the argument is that I'm not doing that with my sort of just background knowledge of the shapes and of D's and J's and my background knowledge of what umbrellas look like. You know, I might just have a list of properties and I just might do some deduction, some inferencing over. You think I'm actually – why is it that you think I'm actually manipulating an image rather than doing sort of like a logical deduction or something like that?
So in that case, the argument would be that it's just improbable that you have stored some information about how to rotate a D and what it would look like with its flat part down. The next set of evidence comes from neuroscience, where people have looked at activity in the brain. And in fact, the very same visual areas of the brain light up when people imagine something as when they perceive it. So for example, when you imagine a face, the face processing area lights up. And further, even the very same neurons that are involved in imagery are involved in perception of the same
thing. Well, if that's the case, why does the image seem so much duller, as it were, than the actual visual perception, if it's the very same neurons?
It's probably not the same amount of neurons, so it's probably a smaller population of neurons. And also, imagery is a lot more vivid when you have your eyes closed because you don't have all that competing visual information coming in.
So I want to go back to Ken's question. I mean, it seems to me there's a false dichotomy there. We often do logic with images. That is, take Venn diagrams or Euler diagrams, or take the kind of reasoning that geometers do on a board when they give a proof. So there's nothing intrinsically symbolic about reasoning or inference. All that you can say is that in computerizing inference, it was easier to do with words than with images. So maybe we understand that process better.
You may be right. Let's see what some of our callers think. Join in. Join our discussion. We're talking about mental imagery with Lara Boroditsky, 1-800-525-9917. And Alex in Portland is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alex.
Hey, this is a great show. This is very intriguing.
You're listening to us on the internet, I take it.
Yes, I am.
What's your question or comment?
I don't know if you're probably going to recognize this sentence, but, well, take a sentence like, the cat is on the mat. one of the advantages, it seems to me, to sort of explaining what goes on in our thought using symbolic models rather than imagistic models is that it's very easy to give a syntax for a symbolic representation. So, like, when you have a sentence, you know, there's a subject and there's a verb and an object. And so I guess my question is, what would it mean exactly to have a syntax for thought if thought were imagistic?
That's a good, very good question, Alex. Lara, what do you think about that hard question? Thanks, Alex.
Well, there are two answers to that. First is people do a lot of very hard thinking, or at least report doing a lot of very hard thinking in images. So Einstein, for example, reported having most of his insights in the form of images, and it took him a long time before he could translate those into more formal definitions. The other question is that even when people are processing language, we know they're creating images of the sentences. So, for example, if people hear a sentence like, the ranger saw the eagle in the sky, or the ranger saw an eagle in the nest, and then later they're shown a picture either of an eagle sitting with its wings folded or an eagle with its wings open wide, if you're reading a sentence like, the ranger saw the eagle in the sky, you're going to be a lot faster to recognize the eagle with its wings open. That suggests that you're forming an image of what's happening as you're understanding language.
I think, though, there's a deeper question kind of behind Alex's thought, because you might think, I mean, suppose I were wanting to be concessive, right? So, yeah, there are these images in there, but you know what? They're not the fundamental atoms of thought, because they couldn't be. Because take John's map kind of, you know, we reason and we have these images, the Venn diagram, but take a map. You can't really use a map to think about the world unless there's a scale. And the scale is, and unless you know that it's the scale is consistently applied, right, throughout the map. And that's given by a description. There's a little thing over there that says 1 mile equals 1 inch. That's a description. So without the accompanying description, you can't really use the image. The image doesn't explain the description. The description explains your ability to use the image. What do you think about that?
I think even images that are projected onto our retina are already abstracted ideas of what the world is like. We're always dealing with abstractions and reconstructions of the world, and a map is just a smaller scale reconstruction. So you could imagine it being along a continuum of images, just a very small image of the world.
I'm granting it's an image, but I'm saying to use it for thinking, you need a key that says that's couched in language.
But Ken, what language is this key going to be couched in?
I don't know, the language of thought.
Yeah. So what we're talking about when we talk about the language of thought, isn't that basically a metaphor? I mean, do we know how the language of thought is organized? If we're not really talking about images versus text, but images versus God knows what, that's called the language of thought, which just is kind of a word for the underlying structures, whatever they are. Is there really a debate here?
That's a good question. Let's see what our callers think. Joe in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Joe.
Hey, thanks a lot. When I was listening to you speak, I was thinking a lot about my language learning process. I'm a Westerner who's learned Chinese. So in the language process, we've gone through going from the tones, and I was thinking of things in tonal. I was hearing phones ring and wondering what tone that was instead of that it was a phone ring. Then we went through the transliterated process of pinyin, which was, you know, our familiar, you know, textual concept of what the word meant. But as we learned more, as you know, in Chinese, there's many characters that represent the words that, so I was able to get an image, and the more images I learned, the more I kept thinking in the images rather than in the text, because the text made it more confusing. So I wanted just to interject that and see what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, I'd like to just add a little to that. Some years ago when I had to travel to Japan a lot, I spent a lot of time learning the two Japanese alphabets. They're not really alphabets, they're syllabaries. And I asked a Japanese once, if since you can say anything you want, or you can write out anything you want in hiragana or katakana, why do you use these kanji, these pictograms? And he said, oh, because you don't have to read them. So, I mean, of course, they do have to read them, but it suggested that there's a kind of more cognitive basic way of dealing with written words that maybe Chinese and Japanese experience that we, with our alphabets and syllables, really miss out on.
People do report that they're very different ways of thinking about the different writing systems. In fact, in Western culture, when we want to really think about something, we kind of talk ourselves through it. A lot of people in Eastern culture report that talking is really distracting from thought. And what you want to do when thinking is to have a completely quiet mind and be able to conjure up images. And this may be related to the writing systems that the two
I thought that
use.
Was a male-female.
Look, I want to come back to John's thought that the language metaphor for as the vehicle of thought is just a metaphor and not very illuminating. Let's give language its due a little bit as a possible medium of thought. Even though our topic is imagery, but the contrast is supposed to be between thinking in words and thinking in images. But look, language has all these cool properties. First, a word doesn't have to resemble what it represents, right? It's not stuck with resemblance. How it represents something, that's another question. Secondly, words combine to make longer things in a systematic, tractable way. How many thoughts can you think? John, how many thoughts can you think? A whole bunch. Mm-hmm. But for every thought you can think, you can add another thought. You think, it's raining. Then you can add the thought, well, John believes that it's raining. And then you can add, Lara believes that John believes that it's raining. So the number of thoughts you can think is huge, potentially infinite, we like to say. And language has that that feature, this recursivity, people like mm-hmm. to say. You can take a sentence, add an operator, you've got another sentence. And thought seems to be like that. So it's not just completely accidental that people thought that language was the medium of thought, because it seemed to explain these properties of language.
Well, but it isn't just, I mean... Again, there's a pun on language. By language, do you mean that thing that we, that public language that we actually speak and understand? Or do you mean any structure that has certain mathematical properties?
Yeah, and certain neural code is what many people mean.
Yeah, but I mean, you can, if you have a map, you can add more detail and add more detail. You can add maps additionally to the side. There's lots of things you can do with pictures that would explain some of those properties.
Larry, you want to weigh in here?
One problem with language as a medium, as the only medium for thought, is that language is very sparse. We have a whole lot of information about the world that isn't coded in language and isn't normally communicated in language. So if I tell you it's raining, I'm not saying to you it's raining outside as opposed to inside the studio, and you have to infer that from previous knowledge. In fact, there are studies that ask people to talk about things that they don't know how to talk about. And it turns out that talking about things you don't know how to talk about makes you worse. So if you ask novices to talk about wine, for example, as they taste wine, and later they have to remember which wines they tasted, if people talk about the wine while they're tasting it, and they're novices to wine, they actually remember the wine worse because they don't have the right vocabulary to describe
it. I see what you're saying.
Language is too sparse.
Yeah. John, you got an email there, right?
I've got a couple of emails, both short. Here's from Caleb. He says, which came first, thoughts or speech? How did humans think before speech if mental imagery doesn't exist? Perhaps thinking in words or some other non-visual ways is part of the evolution of thought. And Caleb, same guy, also says, we understand that light can behave in different ways, sometimes particle-like, sometimes wave-like. Why can't that duality, something like that, apply to thought, too? Sometimes word-like, sometimes image-like.
Larry, what do you think?
I think the ultimate answer is going to have to be that it's both. And the real trick is figuring out how you translate from one format to another. We know that visual information comes into the brain, and we know that language comes into the brain, and we know that we can translate from one to the other. You can see something out in the world and call it by its name, or you can hear a name and conjure up an image and pick it out of a visual array. The real question is, how do you translate between one and the other? That's the key question.
David in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, David.
Hi, I just want to follow up on the comment made about the kanji. I think we have that in our culture as well. When you see a no smoking sign that's a pictogram or the image of a woman or a man on a restroom door, I think you don't have to read those either. But my question is, can we think about how animals who obviously don't have language skills and developed sentence structure, they must think in images in order to perform the acts that they do. Doesn't that tell us something about the human mind and where that came from?
David, I'm going to tell you something. We're going to do a show on animal minds in a few weeks, and we'll give you some thick answers to those questions. But, Lara, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, it's very hard to know what it is that animals imagine, even harder than it is to know what other people imagine. But there actually was a study done on sheep and sheep's ability to recognize other sheep by their smell. And it turns out that if you present a familiar sheep smell to another sheep, the parts of the brain that usually process sheep faces light up in that sheep. So you could think of that as a sheep imagining its friend sheep as it's smelling it. In its mind.
That's a great day. See, that's why we have not just philosophers on here. No philosopher would know a fact like that.
That's when sheep usually get those sheepish grins.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing mental imagery with Lara Boroditsky.
We've been talking about the scientific evidence for the existence and importance of mental imagery. Next, we'll ask whether mental imagery has any implications for how we learn and reason about the world.
The epistemological significance of mental imagery when Philosophy Talk continues.
In the windows of your mind.
Oh, Dusty Springfield, isn't she wonderful? And the windmills of your mind. I'm John Perry, a mind full of windmills. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. John, you've spent your career tilting at windmills? Is that what it is?
No, tilting at the language of thought.
Yeah, we're discussing mental imagery with our colleague from Stanford, Lara Boroditsky, from the psychology department at Stanford. Lara, look, let's concede. Let's let the mental imagery guys win this debate for the purposes of this show. You know, it's a hot topic. There's lots of controversy, but let's suppose they win. Well, really, what difference would that really make if the mental imagery guys just won to our understanding of how reasoning works, how inference works, how, you know, how we cognize the world? I mean, does it show anything deep if the mental imagery debate is settled on behalf of the imagistics?
Well, I think it doesn't have to be an either or. It could be that both exist. And I don't think people who believe in imagery believe that that's the only currency of thought. They are just trying to show that that is one of the currencies of thought. But one thing that is very compelling about mental images is that when we formed a mental image, it can enter our memory and it can seem as though it's something that we really experience. So let me give you an example. In 1992, there was a plane crash. An El Al plane crashed into a building in Amsterdam. And about 6 months later, people were asked, do you remember watching the film of that plane hitting the building? And about half of the people who were asked this question said they remembered seeing the film, and they also remembered incidental details, how tall the flames were and the smoke and so on. Now, there had never been any footage of this plane crash, so no one could have seen the film. But people, when they read about the story, they imagined it in vivid detail, and it became part of their memory of what happened.
But let me, okay, that's cool. I love that. I want to see how broad and deep this stuff goes. I mean, you know, somebody tells me about a plane crash and all sorts of stuff. I can infer what must have happened. I can form images of what it must have been like. I can do all this stuff, right? And what I'm trying to figure out is what aspects of our knowing and understanding can't be explained by appeal to language-like representations that can be explained by appeal to imagistic, you know, and what parts of our reasoning can we say, that must be driven by manipulation of imaging? That's what I'm trying to understand.
Well, that question really goes back to Steve Coslin's point that there's lots of information in images that we don't usually code in language, that isn't usually coded symbolically, but you can go back and examine an image that you have stored and come up with more details and then code it and store it and then have it more accessible. So information about size, any kind of metric information, orientation, perspective, all of these things are not necessarily coded in symbolic
Think of something as simple as reaching out and getting a coffee cup, bring it to your lips, take a drink. We have, at least in natural language, very sparse vocabulary for describing it. That cup is there, and yet I can move my hand directly to it, and if it was a couple millimeters away or centimeters away, I would move my hand directly there. So there's some kind of, I would think, analog way of representing the world that's very basic to our control of our movements, which are very analog in nature.
Well, that's interesting, but tell me if I'm right or wrong about this. When I see something, I see it in, let's call it an egocentric space. I imagine it. I see it in relationship to me. I imagine an airplane flying and crashing. I don't imagine myself in that image, looking at it from a certain. I mean, I sort of imagine it from a certain. I imagine a certain side of it, I guess, or I can imagine this side or that. But I don't really put myself in there, do I? I mean, isn't the space in which I imagine different from the space in which I see? So John's point, it wouldn't help.
Actually, if I ask you to imagine a rabbit, for example, again, if you imagine that rabbit, if I ask you about properties of the rabbit that are not visible in the image, it'll take you longer to verify them. So if I ask you, does the rabbit have a tail? It'll depend on whether you're imagining a sideways rabbit or a rabbit from face on.
Later today, Ken, you're going to be watching the Super Bowl. If you're part of American culture, I'm not sure you'll be watching the Super Bowl. When you watch the Super Bowl, I mean, you're not there in the stadium and you might not know whether it's in Miami or Texas when you watch it. So surely when we perceive ordinarily, we have some conception of where we are with regard to the things we perceive, but that's not always the case.
Yeah, you're right.
We have an email here that brings up an interesting thing we haven't talked about. How does this debate address dreams, which are an example of subconscious thought? Dreams, in my experience, are highly visual. I go along with, this is from Phil, I'll go along with Phil on that. And there does not seem to be a question of whether they are primarily created from words or images. I guess Zenon and Ken mainly dream in words, but I would miss out on a lot if I didn't dream in images.
But you're confusing something when you say that. Your remark confuses something, I think. If Politian were here, I don't think he would deny the phenomena of dreaming and imagining and all that. Somebody says, imagine something. Politian wouldn't say, we don't imagine. But I guess he would say that imagining doesn't consist in having an image, a picture-like image. It's some other kind of intellectual capacity. I'm not quite sure what he would say about what goes on in the activity of imagining. I mean, how exactly he would describe that. But he wouldn't deny that there's such a thing as imagining, would he?
I think there are, well, going back to the question of dreaming, I think there are very few people who have the experience of dreaming in words, though people do have dreams in particular languages and so on, so words are part of dreams. But I think Politian would say that basically everything that you need to do mentally, you can do in symbolic logic. And so all the other phenomena that you observe are epiphenomenal.
Right.
They're just downstream consequences of doing the symbolic logic. And on the other hand, people argue that symbolic logic just isn't enough to do the kinds of things that people can do.
Well, I mean, there can't be much doubt that underlying our intellectual processes are some huge databases where we store the information we get from perception used to guide what we do in action. And it seems strange to me to suppose that that fact alone wins the debate between thought and image. When I am not a big imager. I tend to think in words, but it seems to me what I'm doing there involves auditory images to a large extent. So I guess I'm a real imager kind of guy.
But I want to go back to what you were saying about behalf of Politian, who isn't here, and you're not on Politian's side of this. I just want to get. So you said you used a fancy. Or maybe I thought a fancy word. Did you say that he thinks that images are epiphenomenal? Or did I just think that when you said what you said?
He has argued that all of the consequences, all the behavioral consequences that people have observed that they attribute to images are epiphenomenal of the actual underlying process.
Tell our listeners what we mean by that fancy word, epiphenomenal.
What that means in this case is that none of those things are necessary for what is actually happening in the mind. It's just they're just correlational, unnecessary consequences in this case.
Right. So it's like what's going on fundamentally is not imaging.
That's right.
Fundamentally, something else is going on, something symbolic, Right, but somehow that fundamental stuff gives rise to the feel of imaging, but it's not fundamental. That's kind of what I think. I don't know.
Well, what does that mean, fundamentally it's symbolic? Obviously, what's fundamentally going on is quarks having charm or atoms hitting each other or something like that. It has nothing to do with symbols. Surely, interpreting the activity of the brain, either in terms of symbolism or in terms of images of external things, are both ways we have of classifying what's going on.
Spoken like a... That's well spoken, I think.
I think in some ways the question of do we think in images is an ill-formed question. A much better question to ask is, when people report doing imagery, what are they doing? What is the brain doing when people report doing imagery? And it turns out that the brain is doing something very much like perception. So, and you can show this almost down to the single neuron level, that the very same computational mechanisms are being used. So if you go out and look at a waterfall, if you stare at the waterfall for a little while, your brain will, the neurons in your brain that process, say, downward motion will adapt. And if you look at something by the side of the waterfall, that thing will appear to drift in the opposite direction.
I think that's really nice, Lara. But now somebody would say, yeah, and we've imported a silly metaphor into the theory of perception, the theory of image processing. Perception is much more complicated. Some people even believe in the language of sight, as it were. I have a colleague who believes in the language of perception. So it's complicated stuff. But I think you're right, that what the claim should be. But then the question is that imagistic or not? It's still on the board. But you know what? We're going to have to end this conversation. It's been a great conversation, as always, when you join us. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Lara Boroditsky, professor of cognitive psychology at Stanford. It's been very great having her.
We've got a lot of calls. We got a lot of emails today. Thanks for the ones we got to. Thanks for the ones we didn't get to. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. You know, John, so you're an imagistic kind of guy, I learned today. You're an imagining kind of guy.
Yeah, I don't think... I guess I'm a non-language of thought is a big explanatory thing kind of guy. What did I learn today? I always learn a lot when Lara's here, but I would like to say one thing. We do background reading for this. It may not be obvious, but we do. And I read a lot of really good things by philosophers that I hadn't seen, because I've never read much about this. And so I'd like to say thanks to guys like Ned Block, Michael Tye, and George Ray for writing such good stuff. And I have a question about Ned Block that maybe you can answer. Ned Block is always right about everything except when he talks about my views. Now, can you can you explain that lacuna in his thinking?
No, I can't explain that. I won't even try. But you're right. There's for a topic that philosophers stopped thinking about under the influence of people like Wittgenstein.
Yeah, a lot of good work out
there. And the rise of behaviorism and all that. Right? I mean, philosophers really stopped. They only thought about this topic for a while in kind of dismissive tones. Terms, right? And then cognitive science started to happen in the 60s, right? And the move away from behaviorism. And some philosophers started thinking about it again, you're right, they wrote some good things. But the thing that strikes me is how psychology said to philosophy, hey, you were wrong to dismiss this. I think that shows something about the nature of philosophical progress and its interaction with science. And then philosophers started thinking about it again. So there's this interaction.
Yes, philosophical progress, square circles. I mean, that's an interesting. we ought to do a show on oxymorons. But I do think the work of these guys is a good example of how philosophy can contribute to cognitive science. I was very proud of philosophy reading this stuff.
And how cognitive science can say to philosophy, rethink your assumptions. It's this interanimation. I think it's really great. But you know what? Conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is coded to ergo blogo, I think, therefore our blog. And you can also download podcasts of our program from our website as well.
Ken, at this part of the show, we often take a conundrum, but a lot of our listeners probably don't really know what a conundrum is. What is a conundrum?
Well, a conundrum is a puzzle, a riddle, a paradox that bedevils the mind and seizes your imagination, and you can't let go of it, and you decide to call Philosophy Talk, and we help resolve your riddle or paradox or give you some advice.
All right, we're not Dr. Phil. We can't solve your problem on a personal level, but insofar as there's philosophical issues to be discussed, maybe we can be of some help.
And we've got a conundrum caller on the line now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello.
And what's your name and where are you calling from?
I'm Lynn. I'm calling from Burlingame.
So what do you do over there in Burlingame, Lynn?
I work at a florist shop.
Oh, that sounds like a sweet-smelling job.
Yes.
So why don't you tell us about your conundrum?
Okay. So I've been getting rid of some stuff lately, and I have a pair of speakers that I no longer want. They're not very good speakers. They're kind of old. They're also on loan from the ex-husband of a friend, and they went through a very messy divorce. That was over a year and a half ago. He's never contacted me about the speakers, and my conundrum is, if I sell them or get rid of them, do I owe him any money, or should I notify him? I haven't spoken to him since their divorce.
Well, let's see if we can find some philosophical pretext on which you can do as you want.
Well, why don't you just give him the common courtesy, even if you're angry at him, of calling him up and saying, I got your speakers left over from the divorce, you schmuck. Do you want them, or can I sell them? Why don't you just do that?
I really don't want to engage him in any conversation whatsoever.
Now, do you have his address?
I have his email address. That's it.
I see. Because, I mean, why don't you could just send them back to him. You know? I mean, you wouldn't have to talk to him. He wouldn't have to talk to you.
Is this out of loyalty to your friend that you don't want to contact her ex? Because would she be upset if you contacted him and offered these speakers back?
Well, she would be upset if there was any contact with him. But also, he also personally damaged our relationship as a friendship by lying.
So you feel betrayed by him?
Yes.
And you're one trying to wonder whether your sense of betrayal, let's say your betrayal sense of betrayal is justified. You're wondering whether your justified sense of betrayal licenses you in suspending obligations that you would ordinarily have that you undertook under more friendly times. Is that what you're wondering?
Yeah, I think that really sums it up.
So why would your betrayal do that? I mean, what are your motives here? Were the speakers a gift to you?
Or? No, they were just a loan, actually. When he would come to my house, he couldn't stand listening to my speakers, so he gave me better ones.
So it was a really nice thing for him to do.
I mean, in a way, he has not harassed you about the speakers.
That's true.
Now, it seems like that shouldn't really be held against him, right?
It's not like you're fighting over the custody of a child. You know, those custody battles over children get really nasty. I've never known a custody, and you're not even the ex. You're
right.
Just a friend of the ex. I've never known a custody battle over speakers between somebody's ex and somebody who's not the ex to get really, really nasty, unless they're nasty people to begin with. Are you a nasty person, Lynn?
I hope not.
Good. You think, is the ex just a nasty person, or just did something awful once or twice, or over the course of a marriage or something?
The awful things he did made him retrospectively a nasty person when you looked back at the rest of his behavior where you were giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
I mean, I've kind of quickly gone over every moral code that has ever been defended by any philosopher here.
Okay.
And I have to admit, I can't find one that helps you very much. It seems to me you're not in our obligation to interact with him in any way that would be unpleasant, but
right.
At the very least, you can find his address, send the speakers back to him, and then you're done with it. You've washed your hands of him.
Well, thank you. That's actually very helpful.
Okay, Lynn. We hope we have morally enlightened you and lightened your day a bit.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
If you have a philosophical problem or quandary that's affecting your work or your play or keeping you awake at night, John and I would be happy to lend an ear and maybe give you some sound advice.
Go to the Philosophy Talk website and poke the conundrums button with your mouse, or just send an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2007.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks go to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Zoe Corneli, and Mark Stone. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.